going on, everybody? Welcome back to the show. We have a Q&A episode. Thank you to everybody who asked a question. I'm going to try to get through as many of these as I can in a half hour. We're supposed to have somebody come and look at the fridge. They were supposed to be here 45 minutes ago. And so I'm sitting in a different part of my house so I can see out the window. In case they come, I'm going to hit pause and then I'll come back. You know how it is. And so, let's jump into it. First question, does the strength from advanced yoga offer the same health benefits as resistance training strength? It doesn't. Even as somebody who doesn't have a full handle on what you mean by advanced yoga, yoga will involve a lot of isometrics, meaning holding a position, and those positions might get more and more challenging as you go to whatever advanced yoga is, but it's going to lack two main things. It's going to lack heavy external loading, and body weight stuff can be really challenging. It absolutely can. But at some point, you're going to be strong enough that the addition of external loading is important for you to get the kind of strength and muscle building benefits. Additionally, it's really hard to work some muscles in yoga. You know, your upper back muscles, a lot of those pulling muscles, you know, that you get doing, you know, pull downs and pull ups and rows and all of that stuff. It's kind of challenging to work those muscles in yoga. Your hamstrings doing heavy deadlifts and lifting stuff up off the ground, kind of challenging to mimic those movements in yoga. Yoga also is going to have a lot of, like we said, isometrics where you're holding a position and, you know, to get stronger and build muscle and you kind of want to have things that are going through a concentric and eccentric phase. So a lengthening and shortening phase, you know, going down into a squat and then standing up has a different benefit to just holding the bottom of a squat. And not to say that holding the bottom of a squat isn't beneficial in terms of strength. That's not beneficial in terms of health. It absolutely is. It's just a less good way of doing that. Significantly less good. Isometrics aren't useless, but when we compare isometrics against, you know, actually taking muscles through a range of motion under load, concentric phase, eccentric phase, we see that the isometric is a lot worse. Some people would even say useless. I wouldn't say useless. So you said offer the same. The way you phrased it was, does it offer the same health benefits as resistance training strength? No, definitely not. The more challenging the yoga is, I bet the more overlap there is just because of the demand, how hard you're working in that more advanced yoga. To say that it is, you know, I'm doing this advanced yoga. Do I need to do strength training? You know, I'm interested in those benefits. You still do. I would say you still do. But that doesn't mean that yoga isn't great for other things. It absolutely is. And it doesn't mean that there isn't some overlap, because there is. It's just not the same. Yeah. And the two main reasons were it lacks a scalable external loading. You know, at some point, you know, you can keep holding isometrics longer, but in order to build strength more efficiently, you would want to add more weight. And then the other is that it is a lot of isometric holds and lacks taking muscles through more lengthened and shortened ranges of motion, again, under load. Next, glutes come up first, then upper body on the concentric part of a squat with a barbell. Is this bad form? Is this due to the weight being heavy? Essentially, like your hips shoot up out of the squat. It's not bad form. It's not because the weight is too heavy. It's just your body figuring out the best solution to the problem of standing up. And so what's happening here is essentially your body acknowledging, your brain acknowledging that if you shoot your hips back, what you do is you're taking some tension off the quads and you're putting it on your like posterior chain, we'll say, your low back and your glutes primarily. And those muscles are in a lot of cases for a lot of people stronger than their quads. And so that's just your brain saying, hey, if I shoot my hips up and back first, that will put them in a more mechanically advantageous position to contribute to this problem of I need to stand up with this heavy weight on my back. So I think that there's room for you to acknowledge this and to try and keep, you know, try to come up more symmetrically. Let's say have your chest and your glutes come, your chest and your hips rise together. But I gotta say, unless it's really egregious, and even if it is, depends what your goal is. Like, is your goal hypertrophy? Is your goal being a power lifter? I cannot say I'm all too worried about this. A lot of times it's because you're trying to squat with mechanics that maybe don't fit your structure, that maybe you'd be better off just doing your squat with a more glute or hip dominant technique. And so I would really want to watch the technique because I think sometimes it's just something subtle. Like people are so obsessed with some sort of objective perfect squat. It has to look like this. My hips and my chest and my glutes need to rise perfectly simultaneously. That's not necessarily true. If you watch some of the like best squatters, that's not what it looks like. A lot of them are very hip dominant and they're, you know, it looks kind of even like a good morning sometimes. So I would really want to see the technique. I'd want to talk about what the goal is, but you know, imagining this not being to an egregious degree, I wouldn't worry about it at all, frankly. Okay, another weird question. Next question. How to progress on overhead press, bench press from week to week as couldn't add weight quickly. I'm not sure what you mean. I think if you write how to progress as the start of the sentence, it almost doesn't matter what comes after that. I'm going to very generally recommend what's called double progression, meaning try to add reps week to week until you're at the top of the rep range and then add weight. And then go back to adding reps until you're at the top of the rep range and then add weight. And when I say add weight, usually that's a small increment of weight. It potentially could be the smallest increment of weight available. It could be something like, you know, 3 to 5%, depending on maybe sometimes you're doing leg press and you're working with more weight and the percent value actually helps more. So you're saying, how do I progress on overhead press, bench press from week to week as couldn't add weight quickly? Well, maybe you could. Maybe you could add 2.5 pounds to each side. Maybe you could add 1 pound to each side. I know that not everybody has those fractional plates available, but what you should be doing is working with a rep range. So if you're doing 8 to 12 reps of overhead press, what you should do is stick with that weight until you can do 12 and then add a tiny bit of weight and then work your way back up. Because if you can do 12 of 60 pounds, right? Let's say you work your way up from 8 reps at 60 pounds all the way up to 12 reps at 60 pounds, and then you add 5 pounds and you go to 65 pounds, I bet you can do 8 to 12 reps again. Maybe you can only do 9 reps or 10 reps. And then you work your way back to 12 reps and then you add another 5 pounds and maybe your reps drop now to 8, 9, or 10 reps. And then you, guess what, work back up to 12 reps. So anytime someone's like, hey, how do I progress on this thing? Again, very generally, double progression where you add reps until you're at the top of the rep range and then add load and then repeat the process is likely going to be my answer. Next question. What's the expectations in terms of progressive overload during a deficit? Continue the same sets and reps every week if adding weight is impossible. What's the expectations in terms of progressive overload during a deficit? I would start, you know, I know you're asking me what the expectations are, and I'm going to answer. I absolutely will tell you what I think the expectations should be. But what's more important is what your intent should be. Your intent should be to try and continue to progress just like you were. Right? Your intent should be to show up to the gym, look at what you did last week, and try and add a little bit more. Like we just literally just copy and paste my last answer from the last question. You should be showing up to the gym with the intent to progress. Now, the expectations are that it will happen slower than if you were eating more. That's a very general answer. It will happen slower than if you were eating more. And what that means is that if you were feeling like you were able to add a rep basically like every week and you were like progressing like pretty quickly, I would imagine that that slows down after a while. I would imagine that if you were feeling like you could beat on most things, that you'll match on some things a little bit more. But your intent should absolutely be to try to progress every week. Try to progress. You won't progress every week on everything, but your intent should be to try to progress. I would say expectations very generally, again, because there's context based on how the size of your deficit, you know, other lifestyle factors, that how you're feeling during your deficit. What does your program look like? What exercise are we talking about here? So I would say your expectations should be to be able to maintain your strength, right? At least. Now, what I mean is that like as you lose weight, you should not be getting, you know, notably weaker. You should be able to at least maintain your strength across the vast majority of your lifts. Now, if we're talking about significant weight loss, there are going to be certain exercises where you lose so much weight that it changes your leverages such that it's not even like you've lost muscle, but you're going to be weaker because you weigh less because of how your body weight affects how much you can lift. And one of those lifts is a lot of pressing movements. A lot of pressing movements tend to go down and feel weaker when you're in a cut and when you weigh less. You know, talk to any power lifter when they cut for their, you know, powerlifting meet, it's bench press that they're like most worried about going down. And so your expectations should be to maintain the vast majority of your strength across most of your lifts. If not, get stronger. I'd say most people are going to still be able to continue to get stronger. I'd say the deeper you get into a cut, the more weight you lose. I would start to shift my expectations towards if I just match. Dude, if you're losing like 10% of your body weight or more, which is significant weight loss, and you maintain your strength during that process, that's incredible. If you even lose a tiny bit of strength, I still think that that's incredible. But your intent should be to train hard, to try and progress. And I think most people would be surprised at the amount of strength and progression they can still see when they're in a cut. But the longer you're in a cut, the larger the cut, the more weight you've lost, I think I would start to adjust expectations to, you know, maintaining strength being amazing. But again, your intent should always be to show up and try and beat last week, right? The point of having that intent, by the way, the point of trying to beat last week is because if you keep trying to beat last week, that means you are going to continue to train really, really hard. And that's what's important right now, so you can maintain lean mass while you lose fat. Next question, what is RPE and RIR in layman's terms? Well, funny, the acronym kind of is just in layman's terms. So RPE means rating of perceived exertion, which is just a subjective 1 to 10 scale of how hard something felt. It's like, you know, hey, John, how hard was that 1 to 10? That's what RPE is. That's it. 10 being you could not do another rep if your life depended on it, and 1 being you could do this in your sleep. That's it. RIR literally means reps in reserve, which means when you finish your set, how many more reps could you have done? So if I say, hey, John, you're going to do a set of 10 with a 2 rep in reserve, that means you're going to do a set of 10 with a weight that you actually could do 12 with. So reps in reserve just means I want you to leave that many in the tank. I want you to do reps until you think you could do that many more. So again, RPE is just a subjective rating from 1 to 10 of difficulty, 10 being the most difficult, 1 being the least difficult. And RIR is a little bit more specific, meaning you think you could do this many more reps. And, you know, sometimes people think of these in terms of the opposite. So like a 10 RPE would be a 0 RIR, where a 10 RPE is the hardest thing you could possibly do. And a 0 RIR means you left 0 reps in reserve. You left 0 reps in the tank. You think you could do 0 more reps, which means, again, the hardest thing you could possibly do. So people see them kind of interchangeably in an inverse perspective. A 9 RPE would be a 1 RIR, right? 9 being very hard, and a 1 meaning you worked so hard you could only do 1 more rep if your life depended on it, right? An RPE of 8, an RIR of 2, and so on. So hopefully that was helpful. RPE, subjective 1 to 10 rating. RIR quite literally means stop when you think you could only do this many more. And on that note, I prefer RIR because it is a little bit more specific to what we're looking to do for hypertrophy, but I don't think you need to be an absolute RIR whiz to get the most out of it. And that sort of balance of we're going to use RIR, but we're not going to stress over how perfect it is something we talk about a ton in my group program, because I like to use RIR, but I know that it doesn't need to be absolutely perfect, right? You're using that as a tool to get in the ballpark of the amount of intensity you want. So if I say RIR 2 and you mess that up and it's an RIR 3, or you mess that up and it's an RIR 1, like if you stop when you think you could do 2 more and you really could have done 3 more, or even you really could have done 4 more, or you think you could have done 2, but you really only could do 1, like even if you mess that up, you're still in the ballpark of the intensity that we're looking for. And because my program is so much more focused on trying to progress week to week, we only use RIR in the first week. I want to repeat that. We only use RIR in the first week, and we use it to get the dart on the board, like just to get in the ballpark of the intensity that we're looking for. And then from that week forward, we just focus on doing a little bit more than last week. So I think RPE and RIR are mega important. You should be on a program that uses them, but I actually just like using them in the first week. Cool. Next, I heard you say recently on the pod that don't cut cows super low because you'll have nowhere to go is false. But during my last cut, I plateaued multiple times and I was 100% adherent. Coach lowered me repeatedly. I was at 1360 cows and in the end, not losing. I don't get it. Yeah, so here's the truth. So let's say you go to 1360. I got to say, there's so many things that if I'm reading between the lines here, I'll try and stay on topic here. But here's the thing you need to understand is that if you were eating, I'm going to use a hypothetical. Let's say you're 160 pounds and you want to lose weight and you start eating 1500 calories. And let's say that helps you lose 15 pounds. I'm making that up, whatever. So you went from 160 to 145. And then you lower to 1400 or something like that. And you lose a little bit more weight. And then you lower to 1300, you lose a little bit more weight. And you end up plateauing. There's nothing you can do to change the fact that at this many calories and this body weight and this activity level, it is or is not a deficit. Like, yes. So your question was, did I adapt? I don't get it. You did adapt. My statement of, hey, this idea of you'll have nowhere to go is false, is because you'll always adapt. If you adapted this time, you'll adapt next time. It's not like you go to maintenance for a while and then you go to this same spot that you left off last time, which didn't yield weight loss, but now it will yield weight loss. That's not a thing. Like, if you cut calories super low, you're going to lose weight super fast. If you cut calories a little bit, you'll lose weight a little slower. It's all in proportion. And if you get to a point where you plateau, listen to me very carefully. If you get to a place where you plateau, you have truly adapted. You will adapt at that point every time. Like, it will always take lower calories than that. And just listen, like if you talk to any bodybuilder or physique competitor, they will tell you very reliably the exact amount of calories and movement it takes for them to get stage lean. They can tell you, hey, no matter what, I end up having to go this low. Because no matter what they do in the off season, where they, like, your version of, oh, I plateaued, I'm going to go to maintenance, I'm going to reverse metabolic adaptation. Bodybuilders do this on the most extreme macro, right? They go mega lean, and then they spend like 9 months, air quote, reverse dieting and gaining and building their metabolism back up. And every time they want to get stage lean, they have to go to the same place because their body adapts in the same way. So you said, I was at 1360 calories and not losing. Yeah, no matter what you do, you will never change that. What I'm trying to say is, like, if you're getting 10,000 steps, eating 1360 and not losing at this body weight, there's nothing you can do to change the fact that that's always going to be the case. You know, there are micro things like maybe you're eating a little bit more protein and you have a little bit more thermic effect, but there's no amount of reverse dieting or that's going to change the fact that if you return back to this exact spot, the exact same thing is going to happen. And I use the word exact because a lot of people are like, oh no, I went away and I reverse dieted and then I came back to those calories and then I started losing. If that happened, then something changed, meaning your tracking improved and you actually were eating less, or your movement increased and you're actually in more of a deficit that way. And so during my last cut, I plateaued multiple times, was 100% adherent. That's totally normal. You're going to plateau. Metabolic adaptation is real. The biggest way you adapt, by the way, is you lose weight. Coach lowered me repeatedly, which if you want to lose weight, is what you should do, by the way. Like, if you are plateaued, you're going to have to create a deficit again by lowering calories or increasing movement. So I don't know if you guys were doing anything wrong here. The fact that you told me you were at 1360 calories, like, triggers me a little bit. That seems hyper, hyper, hyper specific. I prefer using more of a range approach, but whatever, that's a separate conversation. So, I hope that was helpful. I just think, like, if you're like, hey, I'm 150 pounds, eating 1500 calories, getting 10,000 steps, and I'm not losing weight, there's nothing you can do to then return to that exact scenario. But now at 150 pounds, 1500 calories, and 10,000 steps, now you're losing weight. Right? There's no like fixing the machinery and then returning back to that same place, but then just now it happens to be a deficit. If it wasn't a deficit then, it's not going to be a deficit now, unless something has changed, meaning you're tracking more accurately, or maybe you're moving more than you did previously. So yeah, hopefully that was helpful. This is a big misconception. What are better alternatives for face pulls? Trying to work the rear delts. So yeah, I had a question on a previous Q&A about face pulls, and I kind of would throw away comment at the end. It was like, I might not actually even do face pulls all that much. So face pull, everybody who hears me say the word face pull is imagining a different exercise in their head. Some people do it with the elbows really high above the shoulder. Some people do it with the elbows at shoulder length. Some people do it with the elbows below shoulder height. If you want to work your rear delts, here are my two pieces of advice. Number one is do rear delt flies on various angles, right? It's a little bit more of an isolation exercise. You can do it with a cable. You can do it with the rear, with the reverse pec deck. Do rear delt flies and do them on a sometimes from a little higher to a little lower, sometimes more on a horizontal arm path, sometimes from low to high. You know, you can work the three divisions of the rear delt. The second is do pulling exercises. So pull downs, rows, stuff in between with your arm abducted, just means off the side. So if you imagine your elbow tucked all the way to your torso, if you flare that elbow up a little bit, you know, maybe 45 degrees, roughly, that's a good spot to do a lot of pulling exercises. If you want to build your rear delts, do a lot of pulling exercises with your arm off your body and do rear delt flies. Do a lot of pulling exercises on different angles with arms off your side. When you're trying to work your lats, we want that elbow tucked to the side. When you're trying to work your rear delts and your upper back, we want to bring the arm up off the body, because what that's going to do, it's going to disadvantage the lats. It's going to make them help a little less, and it's going to line up the rear delts a little bit more. So you're kind of attacking this on two fronts. You're putting the rear delts in a better position to help, and you're putting the lats, a really strong muscle, in a worse position to help, right? So the net effect of that is that the rear delts will work more. So do a lot of pulling exercises with the arm off the body, and do rear delt flies. Again, let me... Face pulls are cool too, by the way. Face pulls tend to be a rowing motion with the arms off the body. They're just not super special. And, you know, yeah, they're just not super special. They're fine though. Face pulls are fine. I'm not trying to poo-poo them. I just think that, you know, if I was going to give a description on how to work rear delts, I probably wouldn't mention the word face pull. I would have just given you that whole spiel I just gave you. Cool. Next question. Is there any reason to rest longer than 2 minutes if I feel fully recovered? I heard there was a study that showed no better results after longer than 2 minute breaks. So let's take out the word 2 minutes, right? Let's take out the word 2 minutes, because how long you rest is ultimately going to come down to somewhat the individual, your genetics and your let's say cardiovascular fitness, but also what exercise you're doing. If you say, is there any reason to rest 2 minutes longer? Like I just want to give you an example. If you said, is there any reason to rest longer than 2 minutes if I feel fully recovered after back squats? I would say, yeah, your back squats aren't hard enough. If you don't need at least 3 minutes after a heavy set of back squats, you're not training hard enough. If you said, is there any reason to rest longer than 2 minutes if I feel fully recovered after dumbbell lateral raises? I'd say, no, I think you can absolutely go if you feel fully recovered. Because different exercises are going to challenge your body in different ways. They're going to challenge them in terms of how much muscle you work. They're going to challenge how much core and, let's say, spine involvement there is. They're going to differ in how much cardiovascular work it entails. A barbell back squat is going to be more challenging on your cardiovascular system. It's going to work more muscles. It's going to challenge your core and your lower back more. And it's going to require, on average, longer rest than something like a single arm tricep extension, right? So if we take out the word 2 minutes and you say, is there any reason to rest longer than I need to once I feel fully recovered, right? So more generally, if I feel fully recovered, is there an advantage to resting longer? And the only advantage that I would say is that you don't actually know what fully recovered means. I'm not saying you don't know that, but if you don't, like, a lot of people get a little antsy when they exercise sometimes, you know, and they are like, I'm ready, I'm ready, I'm ready. It's like, well, are you ready, or are you just antsy and you want to keep going, you know? Or are you a little bit addicted to that huffy and puffy, tired, fatigued feeling of being, you know, exhausted? And so I would nudge people on average to maybe go intuition plus one, meaning like whatever your intuition says that you feel recovered, maybe go a little bit longer than that, just to kind of hedge the fact that maybe you are trying to get through it a little quickly and might benefit from going a little bit longer on your rest periods. But the truth is, if you feel fully recovered, if you really think you're recovered, you can go. You can go. Hypertrophy and rest periods, it's not that important. As long as you're like, I don't want to go down that whole rabbit hole, but you can see really good muscle growth with a little bit less rest, a little bit more rest. You know, you can do a little bit less rest and do a little bit more sets, and you can certainly kind of equate muscle growth. But I'm not exactly sure which study that you're talking about, but we have so many studies on rest periods. But it depends on the exercise. Because if you told me you were resting 2 minutes for squats and you're not getting any better results resting longer, I would call BS on your training intensity. But if you're like, hey, if I rest 2 minutes on my lateral raises or 3 minutes, I feel like I perform the same. Yeah, I would believe that 100%. And we did a little bit of like an N of one study when we were at N1 in Colorado. We did a 2 minute rest versus 3 minute rest period for single arm bicep curls. And I found that 2 minutes was sufficient, that I did not meaningfully improve my performance with that extra minute of rest. But we did the same experiment with RDLs, and I absolutely improved performance with that extra minute of rest. So it does depend on the exercise. Next, is protein less important on non-training days? Yes, but no. Or do the muscles still need protein on rest days as they're still using it to rebuild? Yes, that is primarily what's important. We see, you know, listen, if you're training 4 days a week, what's happening is when you lift weights, we see an increase in what's called muscle protein synthesis, which is just basically a signaling pathway of building new muscle tissue. And that's elevated after a workout for, you know, 24, 48, almost 72 hours. So you kind of, if you're lifting 3 days a week, you kind of imagine that you're always in a state of breaking down, building back up. You know, muscle protein breakdown and muscle protein synthesis is always happening. And so you know, I think you could say that technically it's probably more important closer to training within the 4 to 6 hours before training and the 4 to 6 hours after training. But I think if we're looking at this in the practical sense of you kind of thinking about how important your protein target is, I wouldn't say I'll hit it on my training days and I'll poo-poo it on my rest days. I would say it's important on every day. Probably not perfectly equal. It's probably most important in that peri-workout, 6 hours, up to 6 hours after, up to 6 hours before is probably the most important time to be eating protein. But yeah, we see muscle protein synthesis elevated for quite some time. And usually within that time, you're training again. So it's kind of like you're always in this state of benefiting from eating protein. Next question. How did you train your dog so well? Mine need training. I would go immediately check out my friend Steven. His Instagram is at verygooddogtraining. He's fantastic. He works virtually with clients. He works in person with clients if you're in the like Bergen County, New Jersey area. He's the best of the best. We used him to train both of our dogs. When I say we used him, I mean he does everything. If you're in the local area, he can do board and train. But the more important thing is for you to get trained as a person. So he trains you how to train your dog. And that's way more of like a teaching a man how to fish sort of situation. And that really helped us with Gunner. We didn't even like formally hire him. We just kind of did what we did with Callie, right? But yeah, I highly recommend that you train your dog. It just enhances your relationship with the dog, deepens the relationship with the dog. And having some structure in the dog's life is good. And also there's an element of structure equals freedom. You know, with rules comes more freedom. And I'm a firm believer in that. I think people, my dogs have both more rules and more freedom than non-trained dogs. Like we have more rules, but that allows us to have a ton of off-leash time. We go hiking off-leash, you know, we go play at the field and, you know, because they can reliably recall and I can communicate with them. And I think that a lot of that stuff is a beautiful experience. Even just stuff in the house where not barking if the mailman walks by and all that stuff just can enhance your relationship with your dog. And it's just whatever. I recommend you look into it. I don't want to be an elitist about dog training. I don't think people need to. I think you can have a perfectly amazing relationship with your dog without dog training. But I also think a lot of people have like a resentful relationship sometimes with their dog because their dog does things they don't want them to do. And they don't know how to communicate to the dog not to do those things, let's say. And so, yeah, I think if you're out there and you are saying, oh, there's things my dog does that are frustrating, or I wish they wouldn't do that, or I wish they did do this, I think dog training is an excellent way to kind of enhance your relationship that way. Next question. What do you love most about Jenna since she's become mom? You two are so cute. Oh, there's a lot of personal questions here. I don't mind them though. I recommend going back and listening to our podcast on Jenna's birth story. We talk a lot about this there, but it seems like it might be a little bit of a cliche, but watching your spouse become a parent is the most beautiful thing ever. Watching Jenna become a mom is just, Jenna used to tell me that she felt like being a mom is what she was meant to do, that she's just been thinking about being a mom ever since she was a little kid. And I do not feel that way. I have not been dreaming about being a dad ever since I was a little kid. That's not like a thing. I wanted kids, but it's not something that I had been to the same degree, like, yearning for as much as she had for just her whole life. And watching her become a mom, yeah, makes me feel like she was absolutely 100% correct, that she is meant to, like, she is such a natural. She's amazing. I'm learning so much from her. I'm so fucking blessed to have her, frankly. Like, I think about what I would be as a single dad, and I, you know, whatever. I have faith in myself generally as a person that I figure things out, but damn. She is the most beautiful thing, watching your spouse become a parent. It's just been, I've fallen in love with her all over again, times a million. Emerson is so lucky to have her. I am so lucky to have her. She's absolutely killing it. And yeah, I'm so proud of her. It's just been amazing to watch. Next question. Will you add nutrition coaching to the group? I'd love help, but can't afford one-on-one coaching. The plan is to do that. The plan was to launch the Mighty Community, my community app, and then ultimately use that platform to also offer group nutrition coaching. For now, I have everything on my plate that I can handle. You know, I have so much on my plate. My plate is full. But the first question that we talked about was my, you know, the things that are hardest about my job. And my answer was that I continue to have to kind of figure out ways to keep myself stimulated, to try new things, to push myself. And one of them will ultimately be nutrition or group coaching for nutrition. But it's just not something I have the bandwidth to do amazingly well right now. But that is the plan. The plan is to use Mighty Networks to do group nutrition coaching. So it's something that will happen at some point in the future. And so stick around and you'll hear about it when I get to it. But I am excited for it. At some point, it is something I will definitely do. Next question. Why landmine is used on cursi lunge or RDLs? What's the logic behind back leg propped up on the wall, single leg RDL? So two separate questions here. So landmine for curtsy lunge. I'll try and keep this simple because it's hard to do this without graphics and you looking at me while I'm doing this. But so I don't like doing curtsy lunges just with dumbbells. You can, right? You can do curtsy lunge just with dumbbells, but you don't actually get as much lateral motion. When we're doing curtsy lunges, you are stepping over the midline and we're getting a little bit more lengthening in some of those upper glute muscles, but you're still on the floor kind of stepping straight down and straight up. But when you use the landmine, if you go to my YouTube and you look up landmine curtsy lunge, let's say, you'll see that because of the way that the landmine is anchored down on one side, it's not just an up and down movement. There is some lateral movement. You are leaning your body weight into the plates and you're not just stepping straight up, you're stepping straight up and into the bar. And so that lateral movement, I think, is both good for knee health, but also good for, you know, working some of those upper glute muscles, the glute med, the glute min, upper glute max stuff. And just generally incorporating some lateral movement. Everything we always do, so much of what we do in training is in the sagittal plane. It's forward and back, it's up and down, it's forward and back, it's up and down. As like bodybuilders or people interested in building muscle, we don't do as much stuff in the sagittal plane, let's say, in the frontal plane, like side to side. And I think landmine curtsy lunges just give us a tiny bit of work in that frontal plane that I really like it. And that's similar for RDLs, but RDLs maybe a little bit less so. I do like a single leg RDL on a landmine though. It is quite comfortable, but I don't feel like it has as much of a unique benefit as doing the curtsy lunge. The logic behind back leg propped up on the wall is just for stability. So when you're doing a single leg RDL with nothing, so if you do a single leg RDL and your other leg is just in the air, there's a large balance component. And a lot of people feel like they would be able to lift more weight and ultimately build their glutes and hams better if they didn't have to worry about balance. So you can do a couple of things with that other leg. And essentially to kind of fix this problem, the B stance RDL was born, where you're doing a single leg RDL, but your foot's on the floor for stability. So other people have said, okay, well, as long as my other foot is touching something for stability, I'm getting the benefit. So what if I put my back foot up against the wall? What if I put my back foot up on a bench like I'm doing a Bulgarian split squat? All of that stuff can work. I'll tell you right now, I hate the single leg RDL on the wall. I really don't feel comfortable. I much rather have my back foot on the ground in a B stance than put my back foot up on a bench like a Bulgarian or put my back foot up against a wall. Some people love them though. I don't see any downside other than, hey, the point is I want to do a single leg RDL, but I want it to feel stable. So what do I do with my non-working leg? So, well, it's got to touch something to give stability. All right, next question. What would be the difference in a metabolic versus hypertrophy workout be? And would it be dumb to make one upper body day more metabolic focused? We'll start with the first one. If we look at resistance training on a spectrum from metabolic to neurological, meaning more metabolic on the left side, and then hypertrophy training in the middle, and then neurological training on the right, it's a Venn diagram. It's a three-circle Venn diagram, and there's quite a bit of overlap. I will say the less trained you are, the more they overlap. The more trained you are in any of them, the less there is an overlap. I want to keep this pretty simple. I'll see if I can put a podcast I did more on this topic in the description. Check the description. If I found something worth putting there, I will put it there that goes into this more depth. But metabolic, you're going to see a couple of things. You're going to see less rest. You're going to see more short position work. You're going to see higher rep ranges. You'll see more supersets. You might even see maybe working deeper into failure. Any other big ones? More short position. The three big ones are more short position, less rest, and more reps. And for hypertrophy, you're going to rest a little longer. You're going to use a little heavier weights, meaning lower reps. So metabolic might be lighter weights and also more reps. Those are if you say one, you mean the other. So hypertrophy would be more rest, heavier weight, lower reps, and a little bit more length in position, because the goal is to build muscle. Where on the metabolic side, it might be to get, you know, greater nutrient partitioning into the muscle. And you can even break metabolic down into two subsets. You can say systemic, meaning I want to work a lot of muscle tissue. I want to work my cardiovascular system a little bit more. And then you can have local metabolic, which is I want to work on nutrient partitioning in this single muscle. I want to do, a little bit more local muscle fatigue work instead of systemic, meaning your whole body system fatiguing. And I'm cautious about how deep I want to go into those topics right now. Would it be dumb to make one upper body day more metabolic focused? I'll start by saying I'm not somebody who thinks this shit really matters. Not at all, but like for the average person, I don't really think this matters. Like if you want to make one of your upper body days a little bit lower in weight, a little bit higher in reps, a little bit lower in rest, go nuts. I don't think this stuff matters all that much. I think people get excited. They hear metabolic, neurological, hypertrophy, and they think that they need to be doing something super hyper specific and, deloading with the other one and then switching to this one and then switching to that one. It's like, first of all, there's no evidence that that's more beneficial than just continuing to do hypertrophy work. So it depends on the goal. But if you it depends how far into metabolic training you want to go. But I don't think it's dumb. It's dumb if your goal is to maximize hypertrophy. But if your goal is, hey, I think this is kind of fun and I'd have some fun doing this, am I going to see really much worse results if I do that? No, you won't. And if you find it fun, you should absolutely do it. So I don't think it's dumb, but I don't think we need to be so hyper specific with these different types of training if the goal is hypertrophy. But if you enjoy having variation and you like having some heavier days, some lighter days, some days where you get more of a pump, some days where you focus on lifting really heavy weights and you want to have those both in the same program, you can. You absolutely can. If you were building the single greatest program, just one program for the rest of your life, and you want to maximize hypertrophy, you probably wouldn't do that. But we don't just train one time. You have to string together many programs over a decade. And so if you put some metabolic work in there, I think you're going to do fine. We're going to go a little bit longer. I have a few more questions. We'll go to the 40-minute mark here. Can no repeat dumbbell workouts, be effective, or are multiple sets essential? No repeat, meaning you just do one set and you go to the next exercise and the next exercise and the next exercise. Yeah, I think it can be. The problem is, a couple problems jump to mind. One is you'd have to do so many exercises, right? Because let's say you wanted to build a near maximal amount of muscles. You want to train 3 or 4 days a week, let's say. And let's use 4 days a week. And let's say you're going to do 5 exercises per workout. And let's say 2 working sets per exercise. So that's 10 working sets per exercise. And 4 days, so 40 working sets across the week. So in your version, you'd have to have 40 different exercises to match that same amount of volume, let's say. Now, that's not perfect because it's not perfect. We can equate for a second as a heuristic, a way of thinking about it, kind of like a version of this to make a point, but it's not exactly the same. If you did 40 different exercises or, you know, two working sets of five different exercises four times a week, it's not exactly the same. But let's say for a second it's the same. I don't think you can think of 40 really high quality dumbbell lifts. That's the first thing that comes to mind. Coming up with 40 high quality, and you could come up with 40 dumbbell exercises, but I think you could probably come up with 15 of them that are really top tier, and then you start to see some drop off in benefit. And if you just stuck with those 15 and you did 2 to 4 working sets of each of them, you'd probably be utilizing more effective exercises and getting better results. So that's one side of it. Additionally, you know, if you factor in warming up for each exercise, now you have 40 different exercises that you know, let's say you just do one warm-up set for each exercise. That's 40 warm-up sets you have to do. And that's probably not even optimal. You might even do more than one warm-up set for certain heavy lifts. Also, if you're just using dumbbells, you know, do you have heavy enough dumbbells for RDLs, for hip thrusts, for pressing, for rowing, you know? And if you're just using dumbbells, it's going to be really hard to do vertical pulling from overhead. So there's some issues with just having a dumbbell-only workout and also doing, you know, no repeats at all. All right, last question. Volume has gotten quite high and spending a long time in the gym. Would like to get back to 60 to 90 minutes without losing progress. Could I do sets with less reps at higher weight? Will that still give stimulus needed to keep progress and continue improving its strength and hypertrophy? So you say less reps, that is a relative term. I don't know how many reps you're doing. If you're doing sets of 5, I don't think you should be going much lower than that if your goal is hypertrophy. But if you're doing sets of 20 and you think, well, if I focus more on sets of 6 to 10, will that save me some time? It will. I got to just say, though, if you're doing more than 90 minutes in the gym, you're doing junk volume. You're just doing junk volume. Junk volume that you're either getting no benefit from, or junk volume that if you removed it, you'd get an indistinguishable downgrade in the amount of stimulus, meaning you're getting so little from the stuff you're doing after 90 minutes that if you even got rid of it, you might even get better gains because you'd be recovering more. But I would more so say that it will make no difference. So, damn, if you're doing that much volume, I have to tell you, you're probably using not enough intensity. Like, you can lower reps, but I got to tell you, like, if you're doing more than 90 minutes, I want to watch you train, and I want to watch if you're going remotely close to failure on enough sets. So it's hard to give a very nuanced answer. My reflex is, hey dude, if you're doing that much training, I bet you could reduce some of that and see no difference in gains if you're training hard. And so, yeah, I mean, dude, if you're doing more than that, I mean, you can tell in the sound of my voice, it's triggering. You can do less and still make gains. You could be training 3 times 40. Again, I don't know who you are exactly, and there's certain things I'd want to know, but I bet you can continue to make gains at 3 times 45 minutes. Imagine if you're doing 4 times 90 minutes. Yeah, you can lower that for sure, and you can still make progress. If you have good exercise selection, meaning, you know, good high stability exercises, you have enough length and position work in your program, and you're training with enough intensity, and you're eating enough protein, enough calories, and you're sleeping well, you can make gains with way less training than you think. You know, three times 45 minutes would be plenty to make gains. So, you didn't mention how many days in the week you're lifting, but this screams to me that you're either not training that hard, or your exercise selection's not that good, or those two things are in check, and you can just do less, and you would be fine, right? Cool, we'll do one more. Next question, what advice would you give to a 20-year-old who has no idea what they want to do with their life? Ah, crap. I promise this is not meant to be a weird question. I love your content, especially the podcast. Thank you so much. Wow. What advice would I give to a 20-year-old who has no idea what they want to do with their life? Damn. I'll tell you, I was a 20-year-old who had no idea what he wanted to do with his life. I thought I wanted to go to law school. I was on track. I was pre-law. I took the LSATs, applied to law school. And ultimately did not want to go to law school. I was just continuing to do that because that's just what I had always said I was going to do. And my family kind of, it's not that they expected it because they put that on me. They expected it because I kind of said, that's what I want to do. So that expectation was built by me, but ultimately that is not what I wanted to do. So if I just go reflexively with what comes to mind when I read this, my advice would be to try hard at everything anyway. I didn't try hard at anything. My GPA for my major was okay. My GPA for my classes outside of my major, because I viewed them as useless, was really bad. Was under a 3. Was bad. It was bad. And that's because I viewed that stuff as useless. And my GPA for my major classes was okay, but I still didn't try hard. I tried just hard enough to pass, you know, just hard enough to get an okay grade. My advice to 20-year-old me, who was this person, would be give your best effort to everything because it's going to keep as many doors open as possible. You know, if you wanted to pivot, you would do you'd do great to have a higher GPA and to be in more clubs and to try more things. And so my advice would be to give more effort to everything so that you can keep all the doors open if you don't know what you want to do. I didn't know what I wanted to do, and so I poo-pooed a whole bunch of stuff that I viewed as useless, but maybe by trying hard, I would have experienced new things. So I think the two things that come to mind to me are give better effort. Don't just poo-poo stuff because at this moment you're not like in love with it. Like take more pride in your effort as an independent variable, right? Not pride in your grade for stuff that you care about, but more pride in like be the kind of person who tries. I know that it's funny. I'm thinking of like 21 Jump Street where what is his name? Channing Tatum looks at Jonah Hill and he's like, you know, trying to teach him how to be cool in high school. He's like, don't try. Don't try at anything. Make fun of people who do try. And it's like the irony is like, then they go to school and like trying is cool. Like, let's make trying cool again. Like, I wish trying was cool. Like, when I was 20 in college, like it was way cooler to miss class and still do okay. Like, I wish that I had more pride in my effort. And that would have kept more doors open for me in life. I mean, ultimately, I'm super happy with where I am, but that is my advice. And the other would be to try new things, join more clubs, experience more things, just get yourself out there. You know, I stayed in my bubble of what I liked. And ironically, I'm in my bubble right now with what I like. But I didn't try enough stuff. I was too afraid of being bad at something, too afraid of looking like an idiot, you know, looking like a fool. And so I stayed within my bubble that made me feel good and that I knew I was confident in. And I wish I'd gotten out there a little bit more. So yeah, hopefully that's helpful. Sometimes it all works out, but I do think about that a lot. I know I didn't give a shit about school ever. And I wish I could go back and give a shit because I take way more pride in my effort now in everything I do. I want to do things well. And I just wish that I had that when I was younger. We can go more deeply in another podcast as to why I think I've become that person now and how maybe I could have become that person earlier. But I really wish that I had taken more pride in my effort across the board so I could keep more doors open, experience more things. That would be my advice. Next question. How many servings of fruits and vegetables do you recommend a person to eat per day? Yeah, it's interesting. Serving is a little vague. I know that there are, I know there are recommendations out there that you could Google. I've never really spoken in terms of servings because a serving of fruit is kind of different. It's one banana, it's one apple. I don't really know how many grams of berries it might be or how many grams of mango it might be or how many grams of a kiwi it might be. So the servings, like in the way you would communicate them of like, you should have 7 to 10 servings of vegetables and fruits. I'm not so sure I would communicate it that way. I think a more helpful way of communicating it is you should be eating, let's say, 3 meals per day at least, and each of those meals should have a hearty serving of fruits or vegetables. So if you eat 3 meals per day and each of those meals has a hearty portion, meaning let's say half the plate-ish of fruits or vegetables, or a side of a meaningful amount of fruits and vegetables, I think you're doing a great job. I think you're doing a great job. You know, when I put blackberries in a bowl, I'm not sure if my 200 grams of blackberries, I don't know if that, as per the like general recommendations counts as a single serving or not, but I'm thinking of that as a serving for me for this meal. When I put asparagus on my plate and I make sure that there's a hearty portion there, you know, 15 spears of asparagus, for example, that to me is my serving of vegetables for that meal. But I'm sure, I'm not sitting at my laptop, I'm sure that like there's a chart that tells you exactly what a serving of each fruit is. And then they would say something like, you know, maybe up to 8 to 10 servings of fruits and vegetables per day or something. I'm making that up because again, I'm not familiar exactly what those serving sizes are. But I would say what I would work on with my clients is every time you sit down at a meal or you order off a menu, make sure there's a significant portion of plants, right? A significant portion of plants. 5 blueberries, not significant. 1/2 a banana, not significant. A, you know, intuition plus one sort of mentality. I teach a lot of my clients that when they come to me, one of the things that people struggle with is reformulating what a portion of a certain food is like. And the kind of cliche one is people who are like, you tell them that they need to eat protein at breakfast and then they send you a picture of 2 eggs. And you're like, yes, that is technically, you technically did that, but 2 eggs is not an appropriate portion of protein. It's not enough protein at a meal. Just like having a, if I'm like, hey, we got to have a fruit or vegetable at every meal. And you're like, cool, I had like a quarter of an apple. It's like, well, we need to recalibrate what a portion of these foods looks like. So how many servings? I would say if you have a plant at every meal, a significant portion of plants at every meal, you're checking this box. Let's do one more question and then we will hit the pause button for another day here. Next one says, you a homie. Thanks, dude. Next question. We should not have done this one. How do you deal with hateful comments on your posts? People can be so mean. You're probably referring to a recent post I did on seed oils. It was a kind of just a funny GIF post. It wasn't even like a crazy scientific breakdown. But there's, as of now, like 700 comments on that post. And, the irony is, although I would use the word hateful for some of them, some of these people were like incredibly racist, incredibly anti-Semitic, incredibly attacking me as a person. So some of them absolutely were hateful. The truth is though, those hateful comments, I don't even see them as hateful. I see them as ignorant. I see them as unintelligent. I see them as like the more hateful you are, the less I value the words coming out of your mouth. So a lot of that is kind of how I deal with them. If somebody's hateful on my post, I had somebody say some ridiculously hateful things. They've been since blocked. But like to me, it almost matters less in that moment because if you're the kind of person who's going to say that sort of a thing, you aren't worth, you know, gum on the bottom of my shoe. You know, like this, like so, you know, I would care more about, I'm not even sure. I don't ever feel hurt if somebody, we call it an ad hominem. An ad hominem is a logical fallacy where instead of attacking somebody's argument, you attack them as a person. And a lot of the people on these seed oil posts, listen, I got to tell you, there's 700 comments on and not a single comment. I want to be very clear. I'm not going to go into this too deep, but 700 comments and not a single comment is somebody showing me the research that I asked for. And it's not even funny. It's not even like some of them did. Not a single person responded with any research about seed oils. Not a single comment. So all of these people, like you can't actually hurt me with your hateful comments. Because the act of you being hateful on this platform where I am looking to educate and I'm looking to have intellectual discussions with other people who maybe disagree with me just proves to me you're not a person worth considering. I guess I would feel more in the way of like if somebody, like, I don't know. Yeah, I can't even imagine. I feel a certain way about those posts, by the way. I have a lot of thoughts about that post. That post scared the shit out of me, frankly. I'm really frightened by that post. That post has shown me a side of the internet, frankly, a side of the world, a side of people, a side of our country that scared the shit out of me. It scares me as I'm talking about it now. I have a lot of screenshots of comments that are really frightening and how similar all of the people in those comments are, how similar they are in their anti-science, conspiracy theory, and I'll just use those words lightly, really was frightening. So I got to tell you, I don't really get a lot of hateful comments. I got a lot of hateful comments on that post, but they don't bother me. They don't bother me because if you're hateful on this app, then you're not worth my time. And that, it's literally just that simple. Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, I would be more disappointed. Like if somebody made an intellectual critique of one of my posts and then, you know, attacked me for not looking at this thoroughly enough. And, you know, if somebody had a legitimate claim, that would make me feel a certain way, but it wouldn't make me feel angry about it. It would make me feel like maybe I should have done a better job articulating this, or maybe I should have done a better job looking this up and researching it. So, yeah, I don't get a lot of hateful comments. You know, one of the things that I thought after this whole, I stopped answering comments on there like 5 days ago, and I still get comments every single day on that post. Something else I thought about is how grateful I am for the community that I have built. Obviously, that post has been picked up by the algorithm and shown to many people who follow carnivore accounts, who follow, you know, these like people in supermarkets fear-mongering about single ingredients. It's being shown to a lot of those people. So the comments are a lot of really angry, hateful people, but that's not my experience on this app for the most part. I have an amazing community. I love my followers. Everyone, you know, it's not even like nobody ever critiques what I say, but I've very rarely have I had rude people in my comment section. Like I feel very blessed with the community that we've built on that app. And so, yeah, that's not, I don't feel that way. You know, honestly, I feel, I feel like if you're hateful, you're not worth my time. And for the most part, people are really great. So we'll end the podcast there. Thank you guys for listening. I will see you in the next episode.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.